This is Taking Aim with
Rob Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, the release of the family jewels, official murder, then and now. Today on Taking Aim, we have a very special program, a discussion with Joan Mellon, professor and noted author, specifically of A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. Today on Taking Aim, we discuss, in particular, an aspect of the family jewels. The family jewels are 702 pages of documents released on June 26th by CIA Director General Michael Hayden. These were released in response to a 1992 request, yes, 15 years previously, a request by the National Security Archives, requesting documents that had been prepared by then CIA Director Colby and initiated by the CIA Director James Schlesinger in response to a 1973 directive that he had issued, ordering senior agency officials to provide an accounting of all CIA activities that had been conducted in violation of the agency's original charter, a charter that specifically barred the CIA from carrying out domestic operations. If you look back in history, you will recall that this had been prompted by the arrest of two longtime CIA operatives, E. Howard Hunt and James McCord, in connection with a break-in at the Democratic Party's Watergate offices. This is the famous Watergate crisis, and it exposed broader CIA involvement in so-called dirty tricks carried out by the Nixon administration and, as we know, carried out by all administrations against political opponents. In the wake of Richard Nixon's resignation, Schlesinger's successor at the CIA, William Colby, assembled some of the record of the so-called skeletons in the agency's closet and presented them to President Gerald Ford. They stayed there. Much of the material in the now-released document has been previously leaked or its contents exposed publicly in the course of House and Senate investigations of the agency. These investigations were the Pike and Church committees conducted in the mid-1970s. But until now, the CIA steadfastly refused to release the material. As the New York Times noted, this material, these long-awaited documents, leave out a great deal. Quote from the New York Times article of June 27th by Mark Mazzetti and Tim Weiner, files on illegal spying show CIA skeletons from the Cold War. They note, large sections are censored, showing that the CIA still cannot bring itself to expose all the skeletons in the closet. And many activities about overseas operations disclosed years ago by journalists, congressional investigators, and a presidential commission are not detailed in the papers. The family jewels catalog, domestic wiretapping, assassination plots of heads of state, mind control experiments, spying on journalists from the early years of the CIA, as well as spying and infiltration of dissidents, notably anti-war activists. Included in these 702 pages of documents, however, is one important memorandum of a conversation between President Gerald R. Ford, Dr. Henry A. Kissinger, then Secretary of State and Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs, and Lieutenant General Brent Scowcroft, Deputy Assistant to the President for National Security Affairs. This meeting took place Saturday, January 4, 1975, at 9:40 a.m., and it ended at 12:20 p.m., and it took place in the Oval Office at the White House. It's a very important meeting, and specifically, a comment by Kissinger is revelatory. so revealing that it is the subject of our discussion today on Taking Aim with Joan Mellon. Kissinger states, Helms, referring to Richard Helms of the CIA, said, all these stories are just the tip of the iceberg. If they come out, blood will flow. For example, Robert Kennedy personally managed the operation on the assassination of Castro, referring to the Cuban president Fidel Castro. Ralph?
Well, I think it's interesting to note that the number of significant figures are involved in all this. In this very document that you're citing, the president is asked Ford, what can we do? Well, we can get Griswold and Lemnitzer and Friendly and Reagan and Jack Connor and Shannon and Dillon. And Kissinger says, you might think of Rusk. This is going to get real rough, and we need to have people around who know the presidency and the national interest. What Colby has done is a disgrace. President Ford, should we suspend him? No, but after the investigation is over, you can move him and put in someone else. When the FBI has a hunting license into the CIA, this could end up worse than Watergate. President, would Rusk have known this stuff? Kissinger, you better ask him. And then who comes in to engage in these discussions between Kissinger and Gerald Ford about how they're going to handle, and Scowcroft, about how they're going to handle this Colby disclosure of the Central Intelligence Agency's 25-year involvement with organized assassination and mind control? An important aspect of what they're concerned about is mind control, and that goes directly to the preparation of programmed assassins. MKUltra is not just arbitrary implementation of mind control experiments, but a focused utilization of the ability to program people to become assassins for very major political operations, such as the murder, ironically, as it would turn out, of Robert Kennedy himself.
Ralph, let's go back to the statement by Kissinger. Robert Kennedy personally managed the operation on the assassination of Castro. Joan, please discuss the significance of this revelation by Kissinger.
Well, first, I'd like to add a little footnote, and that is when Kissinger says about Colby, after the investigation is over, you could move him and put in someone of towering integrity, I just want to add for the listeners that the person, of course, who replaced Colby was George W. H.W. Bush as director of Central Intelligence, and he was the person who was going to play ball with them. Colby was too friendly to the church committee and gave away too many of the family jewels. And the other point I'd just like to make to start with is that the National Security Archive made this request in 1992 pursuant to the JFK Act, which had just been passed and which had mandated that the CIA release all assassination-related records. And so in 1992, that was a good thing to do. Now, or a possible thing to do.
Joan, why don't you, Joan, say a word. Just say a word, since you mentioned that the replacement was none other than Bush Sr. Briefly, Bush Sr.'s longstanding association with the agency, and in particular in relation both to Bay of Pigs and the events surrounding the assassination of Kennedy.
Well, that gets us started on George H.W. Bush, the father. And one of the things that George H.W. Bush said during his confirmation hearings in 1976 when he was appointed director of Central Intelligence was that he had no prior relationship with the CIA. And in my new research that I'm doing, what I found is an enormous record of CIA relationship between Bush Sr., with Bush Sr., rather, starting really from the time that he was brought to Texas by H. Neil Mallon and in the founding of his companies Zapata and Zapata Offshore. And I think what Ralph is referring to there is the fact that the Bay of Pigs operation was had the name Zapata as its code name, indicating how closely related Bush was to the CIA, certainly in 1961.
Well, actually, the two of the patrol boats, one of them was named the Barbara.
Mm-hmm.
And the other?
The other, I forgot.
I think it was the Zapata.
Uh-huh.
You see, so two of the actual patrol boats used in the Bay of Pigs operation one which was imposed to some extent on the Kennedy brothers that they had great doubts about, particularly with its corollary demand of U.S. backup with troops and Air Force and so on. And there is Bush Sr. at the very center of this particular operation, clearly a covert op motivated and located in Texas, as companies being formed around that whole nexus that we're just describing here.
Now, I'd like to go back to your question, Maya, and that was about Robert, this quotation from Richard Helms. Robert Kennedy personally managed the operation on the assassination of Castro, which is only half true. In fact, what happened there, Robert Kennedy immediately took an office at Langley. He was very rarely in the Attorney General's office, and he pursued his own operations for the assassination of Fidel Castro. The CIA, on a parallel track, pursued its own. They did not share intelligence largely. And one of the points we're addressing here is the notion that Robert Kennedy had nothing to do with these plots to assassinate Castro, which is plainly not true. I have so much evidence here that I don't know where to begin, but I'd like to begin with something that one of the important documents that we have here is the oral history that was made for the Central Intelligence Agency by one of its members of the clandestine service who worked closely with Richard Helms, whose name was Sam Halpern. And Sam Halpern is reminiscing here in 1998 over events over what he had done in CIA, and he says several very interesting things about Robert Kennedy. One is that and that amazed Department of Justice lawyers who worked with Kennedy at the time. It was well known that while Robert Kennedy was supposedly putting people in the mafia in jail, and they kidnapped Carlos Marcello on the streets of New Orleans and so forth, at the same time, Robert Kennedy had enlisted a CIA operative named Charlie Ford, who went under the pseudonym at the time, Rocky Fiscalini. And he was sent to both in the United States and particularly in Canada to search for mafia people who might help in assassination plots against Castro. And Halpern reveals this in his oral history. He has absolutely no reason to lie. But we have so much evidence of this that I don't really know even where to begin. In this oral history,
Joan, let me interrupt you first. You talk about an oral history. This is an oral history that the CIA prepared itself
Its
own members?
Excellent.
Its own agents?
That's correct. That the CIA has writes its own history. Oh, yes. I mean, if you read Don DeLillo's novel, Libra, you'll find that one of the central characters is named Nicholas Branch, who sits in an enclosed room and writes the official history of the Kennedy assassination for the CIA. And he's locked in this room for years, and document upon document, they keep bringing in new documents, and he sits there almost suspended in time, writing for the CIA the history of the Kennedy assassination.
And how did this oral history come out?
So
this
oral history, that's a good question, too. It's a document at the National Archives. Anybody can have it. The CIA contributed it. The originator here is the agency file number just says history staff. The originator is CIA. It's from the two CIA employees who did the interview, named Brian Littell and Michael Warner. And the subject is Sam Halpern, and the date that they did this oral history is April 7th, 1998, and it's a secret document.
Well, Joan...
But I'm not done. Go ahead, Ralph. Go ahead.
Well, I want to relate this to the role of RFK and what Kissinger, Ford, and Brent Scowcroft are mentioning when they say these stories are the tip of the iceberg. If all that we did emerged, blood would flow. And then it goes on to say about RFK managing personally an assassination program aimed at Fidel.
Well, by the way, some of that material about Robert Kennedy is not exactly secret. For example, there was a group, part of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board under President Kennedy. It was called the Special Group Augmented, the augmentation was Robert Kennedy. And there was a discussion on August 10th, 1962, minutes available, where General Edward Lansdale, now General Edward Lansdale was a CIA operative in Vietnam, whom Robert Kennedy enlisted to help him formulate plots to murder Fidel Castro. And openly, Lansdale talks about, quote, elimination of leaders. And Sam Halpern is referring to this, and he's shocked. And William Harvey, who was in charge of ZR Rifle, which was the executive action, which was the murder program of the CIA involved in the assassinations of foreign leaders, such as Lumumba, the attempted assassination of Lumumba, which is mentioned also in the new Family Jewels. Well, Halpern is amazed, and Harvey was amazed that Lansdale would speak about that in actually where it would be in writing. And Halpern says, puts it in writing, and Harvey goes through the roof. It's all out there now, but that's the kind of people who don't know what the hell it's all about.
So
that is Lansdale. You don't say anything. It took tremendous effort on the part of everybody, the National Security Archive, and all the people who have worked in this field to try to get, and I think we have to thank Oliver Stone and for having the courage to have made the film, which led to public outcry, which led to the passage of the JFK Act, which really is responsible for the release of these family jewels. You would not see them if there were no JFK Act. Let's remember that. And I want to mention one incident that I wrote about in A Farewell to Justice, which is that the head of the Office of Naval Intelligence in New Orleans, his name was Guy Johnson. And Guy Johnson was sent to Washington, D.C. He's in the Oval Office with John F. Kennedy and Robert Kennedy, and they are discussing with a naval commander the recruitment of a sniper to go into Cuba and to shoot Fidel Castro. I mean, this naval commander was also an ONI operative, which is how Guy Johnson came to, and his name was Richard Gordon. And right there's John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Dean Rusk is present, and Gordon is enlisted by the Kennedys to train a marksman to kill Castro. The sniper actually sets forth, tries to get into Cuba, is picked up by Castro, never seen again. But this was just one example. We have the reason that we know about this incident, not that Guy Johnson talked about it, but that Gordon was then he was a very dangerous person to have around, and he got into various trouble, and F. Lee Bailey had to defend him. And, of course, F. Lee Bailey then learned the story and told it to me. So the idea that no one talks, that the information doesn't become available, is not true. The idea that Robert Kennedy and his brother were involved in attempts to murder Castro is just plainly not true. The evidence is overwhelming, and I think Ralph and I interviewed Ramsey Clark together, and Ramsey Clark told us that when he became Attorney General, now Robert Kennedy was Attorney General, then he was replaced by Nicholas Katzenbach, and then Ramsey Clark came in. Lyndon Johnson really was very uncomfortable with Katzenbach as being a Kennedy loyalist. And there's Ramsey Clark opens his desk, and he discovers a memo that remained there from the Robert Kennedy times. And there was a memo from General Lansdale to Robert Kennedy outlining some of the plot to murder Fidel Castro. And Ramsey Clark was amazed. And Ramsey Clark said to us that during that interview, he had tried over and over to rein Robert Kennedy in. It wasn't only the plots to murder Fidel Castro that Bobby Kennedy was involved in. It was also really, he broke the law on every front. And I think the big example of that, we may not have time to go into it today, was the prosecution of Jimmy Hoffa.
Well, Joan, I do want to go into that today. But before we do, since you brought up our discussions with Ramsey and their extended discussions, Ramsey and I go back 30 years, but I want to mention that the memo from Edward Lansdale to RFK regarding enlisting Lansdale in a Robert Kennedy plan to kill Fidel is only part of the story. After all, Lansdale is deeply involved in the circumstances surrounding the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and all that RFK was planning to do with Lansdale, Lansdale was reporting to J. Edgar Hoover, unbeknownst to Robert Kennedy. And, of course, Hoover is a figure involved in plots against the Kennedys from the get-go. So this takes on a dimension here of a very real internecine conflict within the ruling class, in which the gentlemen killers of the CIA are turning on each other, out of which emerges the coup d'etat represented by the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And in many respects, the elements that underline that conflict within the ruling class over tactics and strategy are being played out today at the current moment. But I wonder if you would elaborate a bit on the role of Lansdale, the significance of his reporting on RFK to J. Edgar Hoover, and how that relates to the fact that Lee Harvey Oswald, who is chosen as the fall guy and the patsy for the Kennedy assassination, is a figure that not only the people planning to murder John Kennedy are deploying, but Robert Kennedy himself is playing Oswald, and thereby, by selecting Oswald as the patsy, the ability of Robert Kennedy, or the willingness of Robert Kennedy, to expose who killed his brother is severely circumscribed.
Well, that's a big question. I think I'll start with Jim Garrison there, and Jim Garrison's astonishment that Robert Kennedy did not help him in his investigation of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Garrison just couldn't understand it. But when we and none of us could really understand it either, why Robert Kennedy not only didn't help Jim Garrison, but thwarted every effort to tell the truth about the assassination. And I can give so many examples, but one occurred when I discussed it in A Farewell to Justice, where Garrison is about to put Clay Shaw on trial, and he appeals to the federal government for autopsy photographs and X-rays of John F. Kennedy in order to use at the trial, and he's a Department of Justice lawyer opposes the effort to get these documents. Garrison's lawyer, whose name was Numa Bertel, wins the case, and then of course the issue was whether the Justice Department would appeal so that it could go on and on. And the Justice Department lawyer said to Bertel, "Wait a minute, I have to call the Kennedys and see what they want to do." And the Kennedy said appeal, and of course the time ran out, and Garrison never got the X-rays and autopsy photographs. Whether or not they were altered or not is beside the point here. So the Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, stood in the way of any kind of truth being told about the assassination. Now, what I discovered from my book was that, which was amazing, I think, to me and maybe to many people, that Robert Kennedy knew well of the existence of Lee Harvey Oswald. That Oswald, in fact, was among the anti-Castro activists whom Robert Kennedy was recruiting for his personal plots to kill Castro. And he sent some Cuban operatives to New Orleans during the summer of 1963, where indeed they encountered Oswald. And one of these operatives named Angelo Morgado talked to me, and he told me that he was one of the Cubans. These had never been identified. The two Cubans with Lee Harvey Oswald who visited a Cuban exile named Sylvia Odio in Dallas in late September of 1963. And to refresh the memory of listeners, what happened there was the two Cubans went to Mrs. Odio when they had Oswald was there, and they're discussing funding anti-Castro activities. And then a day or two later, one of the Cubans telephones Mrs. Odio, and he says, you know, that Leon, he was called Leon then, Leon Oswald is really crazy. He's talking about killing President Kennedy. And Angelo Morgado, the other Cuban, who was Robbie Kennedy's representative, was, of course, overwhelmed, shocked. He said he vomited when, on November 22nd, he saw that Oswald was arrested. And this person, whom he had thought was an anti-Castro activist and, you know, was in his own domain there, was actually, he didn't know, was, you know, involved in the murder of President Kennedy. Now, Bobby Kennedy, when the assassination occurred, immediately said to his press secretary, Frank Mankiewicz, "Do you think any of our guys were involved?" Well, who are our guys if not the Cubans whom Robert Kennedy was enlisting in murder of and plots against Fidel Castro? And Mankiewicz looked at him and he thought to himself, he didn't say this, "Do you think there might have been?" And, of course, what Bobby Kennedy thought was indeed that there might have been. So ever after, what we see in Robert Kennedy is efforts to cover up his own. Jim Garrison in New Orleans, they're looking at anti-Castro Cubans and their role in the assassination. Robbie Kennedy was terrified that Garrison would find out about the fact that Bobby Kennedy had knowledge of Oswald prior to the assassination. One of the things I discovered is that Bobby Kennedy had knowledge of Oswald even before the summer of 1963. And in some of my ongoing research, I'm looking at the shooting of General Edwin Walker by Oswald in April of 1963. This is before Oswald even goes to New Orleans. This is in Dallas. And then General Walker, ever after, was persuaded that Bobby Kennedy had sent a memo from the Department of Justice to the Dallas police saying that Oswald should not be apprehended for shooting at the attempted assassination of General Walker. Well, that's rather amazing. Now, the document that's involved is missing from the archives of the Dallas police. So we can see how this cover-up really, you know, was very well oiled and worked very, very, very well.
And
we
Joan,
get to, sorry.
Wait, Joan, who was General Walker, and why would there be an assassination attempt on him?
Well, if Oswald is being set up to as the coming assassin of it's not so far off from April to November, wouldn't it be good to have a record for Oswald of a previous assassination attempt? General Walker was a right-wing general who'd retired from the army and was minding his own business on this particular occasion, was sitting in his living room, and the shots come in through the window. And I mean, we could only think that this is part of the framing of Oswald long before the actual assassination in Dallas.
Well, let's look at that a moment, because one of the, I mean, on your website are three extraordinary articles. And those articles pertain to a figure known as Walter Sheridan. And Walter Sheridan is a person who was answerable to Robert Kennedy directly and had a long history with the CIA and the FBI and was essentially a stone-cold thug deployed to suborn perjury, terrorize witnesses, bribe them, threaten them with imprisonment or death or worse, because when I mean worse is consequences for their families. And he is Robert Kennedy's man, and Mr. Sheridan is now being sheep-dipped by the likes of David Talbot in his recent what can I call it?
Cartoon.
This cartoon book.
A fairy tale.
Called The Brothers, about the Kennedy brothers, romanticizing the Kennedy brothers and representing them and as the warriors for peace, and in particular presenting Walter Sheridan as a heroic figure trying to uncover the Kennedy assassination. Discuss the significance of Walter Sheridan in his destruction of the attempts to expose who killed Kennedy and his relationship to Robert Kennedy in this process.
Well, Ralph, first we have to look at Sheridan's official title, confidential assistant to Robert Kennedy. And Walter Sheridan had, first of all, one of the agencies that we left out in the discussion was National Security Agency, which is well known to all of us now for its illegal surveillance of citizens of the United States. So Sheridan here is working for Robert Kennedy since the days of the McClellan Committee, where Bobby became Bobby as we know him. And Walter Sheridan really...
Would you date that, McClellan?
Oh, I don't... the McClellan Committee had to be in the 50s.
Yes.
I can't date the exact date.
No, that's correct.
We're in the 50s. Anyway, when we get to the area we're talking about, what Sheridan did for Bobby Kennedy, and I discussed it on www.joanmellon.net, three articles that Ralph is referring to, the three articles about Walter Sheridan, the three areas that Sheridan operates in for Bobby Kennedy. First of all, the Get Hoffa. Bobby had this obsession with putting Jimmy Hoffa in jail. And we have to leave out in our discussion here whether or not Hoffa was guilty, but rather we're talking about the methods that were used, as Ralph described them, to nail Hoffa.
But, Joan, let me just stop you for one brief moment here about this, because the role of Robert Kennedy and the role of Walter Sheridan in destroying Jimmy Hoffa and the methods that were used go to the heart of the family jewels, go to the heart of the question of the use of surveillance, the use of wiretaps, of compromising the ability to have an attorney and a due process trial. They go to all the issues that the Bush administration is accused of embracing, namely the abrogation of normal constitutional rights with the so-called enemy combatants and military tribunals and renditions and disappearances, and the elimination of the right to a fair trial for the attorneys themselves to be compromised in the process. All of that is rooted in the role of Walter Sheridan and Robert Kennedy in the Get Hoffa campaign.
Well, I hope Ralph will soon discuss for us why the CIA released these documents to the National Security Archive at this moment after they were requested in 1992. But when I look at just to give us a little quick summary about Sheridan's activities for Bobby Kennedy. First of all, chronologically, Walter Sheridan and Bobby Kennedy succeeded in removing from the Office of Security of the State Department a figure named Otto F. Otepka. Mr. Otepka was really in charge of doing background checks on personnel being hired by the State Department. And he could not understand for years why he was drummed out of his position and reassigned, taken out of the Office of Security, why this happened. And when I began to study this question, question, and we see, first of all, Mr. Otepka being surveilled. Illegal tapes are being made, wiretaps. I mean, Bobby Kennedy was absolutely obsessed by wiretaps, and he wiretapping all over the place. And he's wiretapping
reporters and dissidents and Martin Luther King and anybody who opposed the U.S. government.
And then also, I just want to say just now a little footnote to this story, and that is that Bobby Kennedy learned, he was so obsessed with wiretapping that he went to an assistant director of the FBI named Courtney Evans. This is in 1961, and he asked Evans to explain to him all the methods that the FBI had discovered about how to wiretap and what kind of technology they were using. And then then he asked for literature about it and materials. And then he asked Courtney Evans to write a letter saying that Bobby Kennedy had never discussed wiretapping with him and had never gotten any material from Courtney Evans about wiretapping. And he took this letter because Bobby Kennedy, of course, publicly, after the Hoffa case, was accused of wiretapping. And William Loeb, who was a kind of right-wing figure but up in New Hampshire, exposed because Loeb had discussed all this with Carthur DeLoach, who was the third in command at the FBI at the time, known as Deke. And Deke told Loeb all about Bobby Kennedy's wiretapping. Loeb then published it in his newspaper. And, the FBI Bobby Kennedy went crazy and was trying to cover for himself. So he produces this phony letter written for him by Courtney Evans. And then J. Edgar Hoover gets wind of this and, of course, exposes that Courtney Evans had told everybody at the FBI and had written as such how Bobby Kennedy had gotten all the information about wiretapping from the FBI. So that's another example of what Ralph was referring to in Hoover's attacks on the Kennedys. He really nailed Bobby Kennedy on that one. Well-deserved, however, because we complain about the domestic surveillance here now by the National Security Agency, and we find the precedent in the Democratic administration of the Kennedys.
Joan,
and that's a point that I'm sure Ralph and Maya can talk about.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Release of the Family Jewels, Official Murder Then and Now. We're having a discussion with Joan Mellon, professor and author of A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. We have been discussing the recent release of the family jewels, 15 years after the request by the National Security Archive, their request in 1992 of documents prepared by long time ago CIA Director William Colby. Joan?
Hi, Maya. I wanted to just go back to now Walter Sheridan's efforts. Walter Sheridan was a lawyer who had a long history of involvements with intelligence agencies, as Ralph said, the National Security Agency, the CIA, the FBI. He was working for all these agencies, was cleared by all of them, was Bobby Kennedy's confidential assistant. And one of the tasks that Bobby Kennedy assigned to Walter Sheridan was to make sure that it never became public that Bobby Kennedy was well aware of Lee Oswald. It began even before the assassination of President Kennedy in the Otepka case, where Otto Otepka at the Office of Security of the State Department was asked to investigate, as part of his job, a series of quote-unquote defectors to the Soviet Union. And on that list was the name Lee Oswald, tourist. And Mr. Otepka began to investigate Oswald. And it was shortly after that through the efforts of Walter Sheridan, all the personnel in the office who were superior to Mr. Otepka are replaced by Kennedy loyalists. Mr. Otepka is put under wire surveillance, his telephone, and also his all conversations in his office. And eventually he is reassigned and taken out of the Office of Security entirely, the better that Oswald not be investigated. And we have to, I did a long article on it on my website about Mr. Otepka. The other effort that Bobby Kennedy and Walter Sheridan made to keep secret Bobby Kennedy's interest in Oswald and later his knowledge of Oswald was Bobby Kennedy sending Walter Sheridan to New Orleans to thwart Jim Garrison. Now, lies have been told about Sheridan's purpose. He was down there to investigate the Kennedy assassination. He was down there to inquire about what Garrison was up to. This is absolutely untrue. And Sheridan himself had an assistant named Richard Townley who worked for the NBC affiliate. Somebody ought to do some research on the relationship between the NBC and the Kennedy administration and Life magazine because they were all in bed together. Walter Sheridan hires Richard Townley of WDSU, the NBC affiliate in New Orleans, and they go around New Orleans trying to blackmail and bribe Garrison's witnesses to prevent them from testifying at the trial of Clay Shaw. And it's very interesting that Walter Sheridan goes down to New Orleans to begin this effort even before Garrison arrested Clay Shaw. I can place Walter Sheridan in New Orleans in February 26th. He's knocking on the red door of Clay Shaw in the French Quarter on Dawson Street. And that's interesting because it wasn't until March 1st that Garrison actually arrested Clay Shaw.
But Joan, I want you to just pause a moment and do the following for us. Because Walter Sheridan does two things for Robert Kennedy. On the one hand, with respect to James Hoffa, Jimmy Hoffa, he involves himself in using every method of bribery and of kidnapping and of suborning perjury to frame Jimmy Hoffa with Parton and with all those, with Robert Kennedy driving this operation. Walter Sheridan, all of the crimes against liberties that are the content of the family jewels are, in a certain sense, encapsulated in what Walter Sheridan does to destroy Jimmy Hoffa. Of course, this is really an assault upon the Teamsters. This is an assault upon the trade union movement and upon the working class in the United States.
On organized labor.
On organized labor
as
such.
On the class struggle in the United
because
States.
Because, yes, as Maya is indicating, if we really look at how the mob is brought into the Teamsters were formed by Trotskyist revolutionaries in the 30s, by Farrell Dobbs, who in his extraordinary four-volume work on Teamster power encapsulates how cross-industry organizing began in the crisis of the Depression in the 30s. And the ruling class was determined to destroy the Teamsters and organized labor. The FBI is brought into the Teamsters. In fact, Jack Ruby...
Well, actually, you have to understand that the formation of the Teamsters, where you have across industry, across the country, was a very significant development in labor from the smaller craft unions of the AFL. So this the history of the Teamsters is extremely important.
In 1939, a man named Jack Ruby murders Leon Cook, who is a secretary of the Iron and Waste Handlers Local of the Teamsters in Chicago. Literally carries out this murder, virtually the gun in his hand. It's on the front page of the Chicago Tribune. The mob is brought into control of the Teamsters beginning in Chicago. That's the role of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, of which Jack Ruby was an instrument and an operative. In 1947, he's before Richard Nixon's House and American Activities Committee, warning about communists in the trade union movement and assigned to Dallas to carry out his work there for the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Yes, this does bear upon the assassination. It does bear upon the relation of Ruby and Oswald. And above all, it bears upon the role of the Kennedys and as an integral part of the ruling class in targeting organized labor and focusing on the Teamsters through the destruction of Jimmy Hoffa. And the uses of Walter Sheridan and the uses of these techniques, of which the Kissinger people talk about it being the tip of the iceberg, and if all that we did emerge, blood will flow, they're talking about the class war that targets the rights of all of us in this country. Please focus on what Walter Sheridan and Robert Kennedy did specifically to James Hoffa, and then ad seriatim applied this to District Attorney Jim Garrison in Garrison's efforts to show the role of the CIA and of the military in the execution of the head of state, a coup d'etat in America.
Well, what Sheridan did, his main tactic was to enlist a criminal from Louisiana named Edward Grady Parton. And Life magazine helped the effort by whitewashing Parton and describing him as, he was guilty of a few domestic squabbles and minor crimes, and to rehabilitate the character of Edward Grady Parton in order to use him as a trumped-up witness against Jimmy Hoffa. Now, the fact is that Parton was guilty of everything from manslaughter to rape to kidnapping to felonies, you name it. And I had a wonderful moment when I was doing my research when one of the lawyers who represented Parton broke with him, and Parton had owed him $10,000 here at this moment. His name was Lou Merridge, and Parton says, you won't sue me, and I won't have you killed. And that gives us a feeling, and so they're even. And that gives you a feeling of who Edward Grady Parton is. Now, Sheridan illegally, it was illegal for federal witnesses to be paid. Nonetheless, Sheridan, through, he used an intermediary, an FBI agent named A. Frank Grimsley, and Grimsley was paying off Parton. So finally, Parton eventually gets on the stand, and he's asked if he's paid. And he says not only is he paid, but they still owe him money. So he blurts it all out on the stand. Grimsley then refuses to cover for Sheridan. Of course, the check was made out by Grimsley, but Grimsley then points to a document where Sheridan authorizes the payment. But that's not only that. Sheridan had somebody, he used minor criminals whom he then could blackmail and say they'd go back to jail if they didn't do what he said. They put wiretaps and microphones in the rooms of Hoffa and his lawyer, and then they prepared their questions for the next day based on those illegal wiretaps. They blackmail people, they bribe people, and Sheridan was even caught out because one of these people wouldn't stand for it, and he made a fake tape, and he used a name called Armentrout, A-R-M-E-N-T-R-O-U-T, and then the next day Sheridan asks about Armentrout, and it's clear that he was using the illegal tapes, or he wouldn't have known about that name. That
but Joan,
invented it. I know these are minutiae.
Yeah, what I want you to focus on, I mean, Robert Kennedy was obsessed with wiretapping, and Walter Sheridan's first job, as you say, was with the National Security Agency engaged in illegal surveillance. And Robert Kennedy broke the law more than anyone else with regard to the volume and indiscriminate use of wiretapping. And you indicated that Assistant FBI Director Courtney Evans was being contacted by Robert Kennedy for the latest technology for the expanded use of wiretapping. But with respect to Jimmy Hoffa, what they did to frame Hoffa and destroy Hoffa, I mean, it's police state tactics that you can only find in Nazi Germany or in Stalin's Soviet Union.
Well, it's clearly obstruction of justice at the highest level, and that is why, by the way, Walter Sheridan then leaned on Ramsey Clark to make sure that his father didn't vote for the reversal of the Hoffa conviction.
Joan, and you're referring to the U.S. Supreme Court review, and this is Justice Tom Clark, who disqualified himself. But Chief Justice Earl Warren didn't disqualify himself, but he was a dissent in the Supreme Court decision because Earl Warren concluded in his dissenting opinion, referring to the tactics of Robert F. Kennedy through Walter Sheridan, an invasion of basic rights made possible by prevailing upon friendship with the victim is no less proscribed than an invasion accomplished by force. And Sheridan's methods, he concluded, were, quote, offensive to the fair administration of justice in federal courts. And he further went on to accuse Sheridan of, quote, obstructing justice. And this is what we see again and again through the actions of Robert F. Kennedy. So it really comes as no surprise, although it will be a shock to many, and there'll be many people providing cover-up like David Talbert does in the book Brothers. But it's hard to do so when you have out of the mouth of Henry Kissinger in this recently released memorandum of a conversation with President Gerald R. Ford taking place January 4th, 1975 in the Oval Office, where Kissinger, quoting Richard Helms of the CIA, states, for example, Robert Kennedy personally managed the operation on the assassination of Castro. And I think in our closing minutes, we should go back to Robert Kennedy and his management of his attempts to assassinate Fidel Castro and the significance of the release of these documents.
Well, but I do want you to relate this. I mean, we show how he framed Jimmy Hoffa, how they bribed witnesses, terrorized witnesses, extorted witnesses, threatened the families of witnesses, threatened the lives of witnesses to forge a frame-up of Jimmy Hoffa. But that's what he did to Jim Garrison.
I want to also say in relation to this something about how this, when we look at the CIA in the 1970s and we look at the murders which are revealed in the family jewels of foreign leaders, Trujillo, about which John F. Kennedy did not know about, the CIA's murder of Trujillo and all of that effort, and the attempts to murder Lumumba, which failed, but, you know, he was murdered anyway, whatever. But when we look at all that, we can see the CIA in a position of strength. Now, when we look at the CIA today under George W. Bush, we really see internecine warfare between Bush and the CIA that kind of mirrors in a kind of strange holograph the warfare that John F. Kennedy had with the CIA and which led to John F. Kennedy's death. So here's George W. Bush appointing a director of national intelligence, minimizing the CIA, and it appears to me that the CIA, in retaliation against Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and that their approach to power and American authority, whatever you want to call it, is to release these documents, because it's at this moment when Bush is, and I think Ralph and I could do a good job on discussing, at this moment when Bush's popularity is at an all-time low, when Cheney has been accused in the New Yorker magazine this week of being malign, of being evil, of being and of having effected a coup d'etat, at this moment we see an exposure of the worst behavior of the CIA, which mirrors the behavior, not of the CIA today, but of Bush and Cheney and their justification of torture, their spying on people through the National Security Agency, which mirrors the spying on dissidents during the 1960s and 70s, and so forth.
Well, Maya, go ahead.
I would like to say that the behavior of the CIA then is compounded by the behavior of the intelligence operations today with rendition, with torture, with torture done by from all levels of security forces, whether it's in local police forces up through all the intelligence operations, with the prison in Guantanamo, the rounding up after 9/11 of Pakistani immigrants throughout the United States, about 7,000 to 9,000 of them, and on and on. The revelation in the family jewels of the infiltration of the anti-war movements and the by the CIA, as well as known infiltration by the FBI, mirrors what is taking place with any dissident groups within the United States today. Ralph?
But I want to address the question that Joan poses. Fidel Castro speaking about the release of the family jewels and all these revelations, and he asked the question, why are they doing this now? And Castro concludes that the reason they're releasing the family jewels now is in order to suggest that this is a thing of the distant past. I think that Fidel is way off the mark in this respect.
His editorial was called The Killing Machine.
Here's what we're really dealing with, brothers and sisters. One has to keep in mind that the fight between the Central Intelligence Agency and, if you like, New Capital, dependent upon the Pentagon and the CIA and engaged in the plan for major wars of occupation with respect to Indochina, whereas the Kennedy brothers in Eastern Capital considered that this was reckless endangerment of the interests of capital because it involved deficit financing and setting in motion vast forces that they couldn't control in the long run, particularly within the United States. These disputes, although they culminated in a coup d'etat with the execution of the Kennedy brothers, as it turned out, are replayed again today with the Bush administration, with Cheney and Rumsfeld, the so-called neocons, that wing of capital that is bought into permanent war, World War IV, the necessity for catastrophic events like Pearl Harbor to create the conditions for the pursuit of these genocidal schemes, unfolding in the genocidal war in Iraq, the targeting of 60 countries for a permanent war condition that Woolsey and Cheney and Wolfowitz and the architects of this with the Project for the New American Century project will last another 50 to 60 years. There is a wing of capital, articulated most clearly by the voice of Zbigniew Brzezinski, as we've discussed on Taking Aim, but 6 weeks ago in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, when Brzezinski proclaimed, there are three words that represent the big lie of our time, and they are war on terror. And Brzezinski proceeded in those remarkable words of his to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, in which he breaks ranks in stating that so lunatic and so unhinged is this purblind rush into another expansion of the occupying agenda to target Iran, even with tactical nuclear weapons, that Brzezinski told the Foreign Relations Committee, be prepared. They will stage an attack within the United States and impute this to Iran. And he went on to disclose the contents of a memorandum that was the secret discussions of Blair and Bush just prior to the war being launched against Iraq, in which Blair and Bush talk about how selling the war on the basis of so-called weapons of mass destruction will not succeed. They don't have any basis for that. So they will have to, as Brzezinski stated, stage a spectacular event in order to be able to gain the rationale, cover, and pretext for their planned war on Iraq. The same is true now with respect to Iran. Brzezinski sounding the alarm. A whole sector of the ruling class says, we would rather deal, as the Kennedy brothers wanted to deal with Indochina, with Phoenix programs, with killer squads, with the assassination programs for which Lansdale was famous, as opposed to massive troop involvement. The so-called capitalist peace of the Kennedy brothers that Brzezinski is now espousing entails blockading Iran, special forces in Iran, creating a putsch in Iran, but not a full-scale war. The release of the family jewels at this point is a shot across the bow of the Bush administration, because the family jewels documents what? Unbridled surveillance, the abrogation of all the rights of citizens in the country, the removal of any pretense that there is the right to fair trial. This is what the family jewels is about, and that is what the Bush administration, with its Patriot Act, has been engaging in doing. So I say that with respect to the release of these documents, it's to put the Bush administration, which is at a low point in its public support, with the whole population opposed to this war in Iraq, in a very difficult situation, because they are disclosing that this is the standard procedure. And the Bush administration is engaged in this very stuff that they are calling a crime against rights in the United States, coming from the highest places of authority. We should use as an historic example when the Cleveland Plain Dealer published the My Lai massacre information, massacres of which had been part of our knowledge and part of the record for many years before. The Russell Tribunal was documenting these. The layman and clergy layman concerned had published a volume on all of the massacres that had been filed by reporters from the field in Indochina that never got past the news desk. Now, why the timing of the Cleveland Plain Dealer disclosing the My Lai massacre? By the way, Jimmy Carter at the time, governor of Georgia, called for a Lieutenant Calley Day in Georgia, to put things in their proper context. The exposure, however, of My Lai was a signal that a wing of the ruling class was prepared to make the continuation of that war in Indochina impossible. I suggest that what we are dealing with here, the release of these documents, is an expression of that internecine conflict where a wing of the class is saying to the Bush people, this far and no further. You occupy Iran, you attack it with tactical nuclear weapons, the whole Middle East will go up in flames, and the conditions will begin to coalesce for a class struggle in the United States, for a working class fight back, for a popular uprising against the permanent war agenda of this new czar that is running the policies of the ruling class in the United States today. That's the context, but we must not fall into the trap that the buffoons like the Talbots, or for that matter their acolytes with Peter Dale Scott and his ilk, in celebrating the Kennedy brothers and romanticizing them, because you're talking about a wing of the class that doesn't want anything resembling the rights of the oppressed, but a capitalist peace that allows for special forces to do the work and coup d'etat to be the instrument, as opposed to massive troop involvement. But the deepening exploitation is the shared concomitant of all wings of this capitalist ruling class. Those are the stakes. And Joan, what you have been doing in exposing who is involved in these assassinations, what are the forces that are at play here? Why was Garrison targeted by all wings of the ruling class, and primarily amongst them the Kennedy brothers, is an extraordinary service in exposing the underlying dynamics of the crisis of our time.
Thank you, Ralph, because after all, in this book, Brothers, Garrison is once more attacked, once more vilified, which proves your point.
Well, I think we're going to continue this discussion, and we're going to come back to these issues, but I would urge all of our listeners not only to read A Farewell to Justice, but please go to the website that Joan Mellon, give the website, Joan.
www.joanmellon.net.
That's joanmellen.net.
Because you must acquaint yourselves with what Joan has done about the role of Walter Sheridan and the meaning of the Otepka file and the role of the Kennedys and the underlying dynamics from 1122 to 9/11. It's the same crime, the same criminals, and the same assault upon our rights as a people, brothers and sisters.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Release of the Family Jewels, Official Murder, Then and Now, will be available on our website, www.takingaimradio.com. Today we've had a discussion with Joan Mellon, professor and author of A Farewell to Justice, Jim Garrison, JFK's Assassination, and the Case That Should Have Changed History. Please read it if you haven't, and go to www.joanmellon.net for more articles on the subject. We'll be with you next week.